Brother, I'm going to start my sermon in Matthew 6, verse 5. Matthew 6, verse 5. And we know in Matthew 6, this is where Jesus Christ taught His disciples how to pray. We also know that before He actually recited what many would consider the Lord's Prayer, that He instructed those listening not to be babbling hypocrites. That was one of the things that we'll read. He also told them that you don't need to pray on and on and on and on, because your Father already knows what you need before you even ask. So that's a little bit of the background. So Matthew 6, verse 5, and I'll actually read all the way through verse 13. It says, "And when you pray, do not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the street corners to be seen by others. Truly I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you pray, go into your room, close the door, and pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think that they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask of Him." And then he goes into what becomes the Lord's Prayer, and I'll just read through it, and then I'm going to focus on a particular portion of that as we go through the sermon. It says, "This then is how you pray," in verse 9, "Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. Forgive us our debts, as we also forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us." Deliver us from the evil one. There are certainly many lessons contained within this prayer. We are told to pray for God's kingdom, which, as we heard from Dr. Lambert, the Trinity, all the false teachings. I'm going to go into some of the perils of this world. We certainly are in need of God's coming kingdom. Last Sabbath, during our Kingdom of God seminars, I don't know about the rest of us, but I was rejuvenated. I was inspired by the messages that Mr. Rigord brought to us. You look around the world, and it's not pretty. So when you come to Sabbath services, it's nice to hear the encouragement and the rejuvenation that we hear when we hear about God's coming kingdom. We're also reminded in this prayer that it is God's will that's going to be done. Not necessarily what we want and when we want it. It's going to be God's will. We're reminded to ask God to forgive our debts, but also to forgive our debtors. Sometimes that's extremely difficult to do. Most of you know that I'm a school administrator. Seems like every time I come up here, I'm in a different building, different position. Come July 1st, I'll be the middle school principal in the district rather than an elementary principal, which I'm currently working as. And it seems as though teachers are really trying to test me at the end of the year. They know I'm leaving, so they're getting all their shots in here at the end of the year. I had a teacher, got a lot going on in New York State as far as teacher evaluation, so they're stressed, they're bent out of shape. And one of the big things that they're going to be rated on is their children's test scores. So with that, and part of the job as a building administrator, is we have to create class lists for the following year. Well, if your evaluation is going to be based on your children's scores, the building administrator creates the kids that you're going to be evaluated on. They're all vying and jockeying for position. They all want the best kids. So one of the other things that the evaluation system does is supposed to rate teachers on the growth that the child makes. So one of the arguments I always use when the teacher gets a low student, rather than all the top-notch kids in the building, number one, we're a public school, we teach everybody. If you don't want the low kids, private school might be the school for you. It's not popular, they don't like to hear it, but we're a public school, we teach every kid. The other thing I use is if you have the lowest kid in the building, boy, what an opportunity for growth. If they're the lowest, what an opportunity for growth. If you're at the top, there's not much growth that can be made. Well, I had a teacher that came in. One of the students in the building has an allergy. So I inadvertently put this teacher or this child in with a teacher that has a rabbit. Well, obviously a kid with a severe allergy can't be in with a teacher with a rabbit. So common sense says you switch two kids, which is exactly what I did. Well, this teacher, boy, was she bent out of shape. She came in yelling and screaming, and she said, "Well, I'll fix that. I'll get a rabbit." I said, "Well, no, you won't." I said, "This child has an allergy. I will not approve a rabbit to be put in your classroom." And she was screaming and yelling, and, "I'm going to grieve this. I'm going to the union," and this and that. And I said, "You know what, Joan? It's certainly your option to do that. But what we have to remember is, what are we here for? What are we here for? Are we here to make our lives convenient? or are we here for the kids? Well, that set her off. She didn't want to hear that because she knew I was right. So, you know, we kind of went back and forth and said, well, I'm going to the union. I said, okay, Joan, you can leave. I said, if you're going to bring the union back, I'm going to end the conversation. I said, bring your union reps back and we'll have a conversation. So the union rep, she takes it right to the top, which is what they like to do. They like to take it right to the top people, the president of the union. And really the way it's supposed to work is they're supposed to be the building reps, and we're supposed to try to work it out within the building, which makes sense. So she sends out this email for some reason copies me in on it. So I replied, and I was sure to copy in the building reps who should be taking it. And basically my response was, I'm happy to meet with you. This is the union, the grievance chair of the union. I said, I'm happy to meet with you. You're welcome to come in my office anytime. I'm happy to discuss it. My thought is it's not a union issue. And it's unfortunate that the teacher chose to go to you and bring you in on this, which you don't really need to be a part of until we try to resolve it in the building. Well, the union reps got all upset about that, which I knew they would, that they were bypassed and they went over her head. They immediately came to me and said, hey, do you mind if we talk about this? Which we did yesterday. And I said, I got to be honest with you. I don't know what is the issue. What is the issue? And she said, I'll be honest with you. I don't either. I don't know what it is. Don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the issue that I changed the high student to her class, and truth be told, she actually got a higher student, but she wanted to focus on she wants a rabbit. She never had a rabbit in her life. But now because she has an allergy kit, she wants a rabbit. And she's not going to have any administrator tell her that she can't have a rabbit. So I went through all the board policies and the safety procedures and all that. I said, very clear, you know, I'm comfortable with her going to the union and grieving it. I said, the building leader is responsible to maintain the health and safety of the children. No allergy, rabbit. To me, that's a no-brainer. She looked at me and she said, you know what? You're right. Have a good weekend. And she walked out. So whether or not it's going to go anywhere, I don't know. But the purpose of the story is really that it's going to tie in later is that, you know, people are crazy. They really are. I mean, there's no other professional or, you know, good way to put it. They're nuts. And sometimes they argue, they fight with you. And there's really no good rationale other than the sake of they just want to fight with you. We had this butting of heads. We're also reminded in this prayer that, and I guess the way I got into that, is we're supposed to forgive those people that, you know, trespass against us. When people come in and their whole purpose is just to get you, you know, sometimes your blood pressure gets going. I know my face will turn red sometimes. I tend to talk faster and louder. You got to remind yourself, we have to be the example. We're taught we are to be the light. Whether they're screaming at us, we need to take a step back. We need to take a deep breath. Go with what we know and just, you know, relax. And I try to remind myself of that. I don't know that I'm always successful with it, especially this time of year when you're just tired of hearing of all the nonsense. But we do. We do have to forgive, and that's not always easy. We're also reminded in this prayer to ask God to lead us away from temptation. And the topic of the sermon, deliver us from the one who creates that temptation, that being Satan the devil. We have an understanding that God will deliver us from this world. We don't know when, and I think Brian mentioned that. We don't know when that's going to be, but we do know that we are going to be delivered from this world at the time of Jesus Christ's return. And brethren, we are very blessed to have that information and that knowledge. We know that the world is in turmoil, but we are comforted. At least I am, and I know the rest of us are as well, that comforted that we know that at some point it's going to end. It is going down. We're not going to have the nonsense. We're not going to have the crazy people that are going to drive us nuts all the time. It's going to end. Because Jesus Christ is going to come back. God is going to establish His kingdom. And His commandments are going to be followed. Again, it's not going to happen at a time that we know. God knows when it's going to happen, brethren, but we do not. So for the remainder of this sermon, I'd like to kind of zero in on the topic of deliverance. As best as I can zero in on everything. I tend to ramble at times. So at the end of the prayer in Matthew 6, we are reminded to ask God to deliver us from the evil and the temptation of Satan. Satan has a hold on every aspect of our society. We are in desperate need of that deliverance that we read about in Matthew 6, verse 13. And you can also read the same prayer in Luke 11, 4. Lori bought me a book, I don't know, it's probably been 5-6 years ago. It's entitled The White Ghetto. And I referred to this book, I know I did in Elmira, I'm not sure if I did here in Buffalo. It's written by a lady named Star Parker. I had really no idea anything about Star Parker, certainly not advocating the book or anything that she writes about. But she talked about what she considers the white ghetto. And what she means by the white ghetto is the white middle class in our society. And what the book attempts to capture is basically the moral decay that our society is seeing. And she says it extends far beyond what many people would consider the ghetto, that being the minorities and the blacks of the inner city. The white ghetto encompasses the people that we see no matter where we travel to. The inside cover of the book says this. It says, much has been said about Bill Cosby's incendiary remarks, and it's been a few years since those, so the book's a little bit old, but it says, much has been said about what Bill Cosby said about urban black culture and its dirty laundry. But Sar Parker goes even further, proving that the urban plight reveals a decay that is gnawing away throughout American society as a whole. The sexual chaos, values disorientation, and social turmoil we see in our inner cities, Parker argues, is merely a more sharply focused picture of the moral collapse in mainstream America. The final paragraph on the inside cover says, covering today's hot-button issue, Parker argues that wealth and infrastructure have cushioned the collapse in the burbs. But the disease, she refers to it as a disease, is the same and only waits for the support structures to falter and fracture before the ghetto culture hits the family down the street or your own home. Speaking from a former high school assistant principal's perspective, I work in a, what most would consider, a white, middle-class, wealthy district. We're definitely not an inner-city school. We are the richest school district in the surrounding area. So when she talks about the white ghetto, she's talking about my school district. I deal with students that complete lack of respect for adult authority, which we expect. It's our job to teach them how to behave. But the parents, I don't expect to have to teach parents how to behave, which I do time in and time out. I had a ninth grade student, and again, what I'm trying to paint here is the moral decay that we're seeing. Many would say that the schools are just a reflection of what the larger society is. And working with the upper grade levels and the crazy parents, I would definitely agree. I mean, you look at what's happening in the schools, you look at what's happening on the news, they're basically the same. So I had a ninth grade student being disruptive in class, a ninth grade boy, and I got a call from the teacher to come up and remove him from class. So I trotted up there, and I knew the kid, and I dealt with him many, many times, so I let our school resource officer, who's actually a town police officer, say, hey, I'm going up to remove this kid. Be ready, I might need you. So I went up there, I opened the classroom door, and I just kind of looked, and I said, you need to come with me. He looked right at me and laughed. I said, I'm not going anywhere with you. So I went over a little closer, and I said, you have two choices. Actually, you have one choice. You have two choices of how you're going to implement this one choice. You're going to leave the classroom. I said, you can leave with me, and you can be suspended for one day, or you can leave with Officer McGrain as the police officer in the building. I said, or you can leave with him, and you can be suspended 5 days, leave in handcuffs, and get yourself arrested. He thought about it for a moment, stood up, walked out the door with me. So he made a good choice there. Well, then we got to the office. He apparently forgot all that I told him. He threw his books all over the office. He's yelling and screaming, all the vulgar language, just going crazy. I said, you need to calm down. And I talked very quietly. I said, you need to calm down. You need to stop swearing. And you need to pick those papers up. He looked me right square in the eye and beep you. Right square in the eye. Use the F word. And the police officer's sitting in his office, and he comes out and he said, use that one more time, you will be arrested. Apparently he thought he was kidding because he looked it right in his eyes and said the exact same thing. Well, he whipped his handcuffs off, whipped his hands behind his back so fast, threw them on, threw them in the chair. Said, you think you're tough now? Said, we're going for a ride in the police car. See how tough you are with real guys behind bars. And he hauled them out of the school and took them down to the police station. So that part of it was done. I still had to suspend them, so I had to deal with the parents. So I called the mom up and said, hey, you're going to have to come in, and your son's going to be suspended for 5 days. I'll explain it when you get here. So she came in. And I went through the whole thing, and of course, son's not there. He's behind bars at the police station. So she signs it, and she said, okay, where's my son? I said, well, he's not here. He got himself arrested. You're going to have to go down to the Horses Police Department and pick him up. Boy, did that set her off. Boy, she had every word in the book for me. Of course, now we don't have a police officer here to arrest her because he's down at the police station. So I promptly said, I'm going to tell you the same thing I told your son. I said, you will be arrested if you continue with that language. He said, certainly I don't want to do that to you. But I have parents in here. I have students in here. I have people trying to work. You can't talk like that in a public building. And she said one more F word and then decided to turn around and walk out. So, you know, the kids, one thing, but the parents. And this is day in and day out. And I work in probably the best district in the area. The best district. So the moral decay, it's coming. It's coming rapidly. I had another incident real quick, and then I'll move on to the rest of the sermon. But not only do we have the disrespect, we have the drugs. You expect that in what we would consider, I guess, the black ghetto. Well, the white ghetto is probably worse. The black ghetto, you know what you're getting. They tend to stay there. The white ghetto encompasses pretty much everybody. So we have students that they're stealing their grandparents' prescription drugs. That's the biggest growing drug problem in white middle-class America, is prescription drugs. And Brian can certainly probably attest to that, all the nonsense he has to go through anytime he prescribes a narcotic. And part of that is you have people that are shopping doctors so that they can continue to get the narcotics, which they're not taking, most of them. They're selling them. And they're selling them to the kids in my school. So we had an incident where we saw on camera that a student was buying drugs. So we had them both very clear that they were buying drugs in the school. So we had the dealer and we had the buyer. So we went and grabbed them both out of class. And we didn't take the police officer. This time we left them in the office because typically when we come with him, it escalates very quickly and turns into be a big mess. We try to get him to the office without, you know, disrupting the entire school, but typically any time. When I was there, it was three male principals. We all wore black suits. The principal was a female. The entire school called us the Men in Black. Because we typically traveled together, and when it was time to get a disrupted kid, we usually went together in case we had to take them down, which I had to do many times. So this kid, we knew they bought some drugs. So I got the person that actually bought them. I brought him into my office. I asked him a few questions. I couldn't clearly see on the camera that he was buying. So in order for an administrator to search a student, we have to have what's called reasonable suspicion, which is a little bit lower class than a police officer who needs... What is probable cause? They got to have probable cause. We need reasonable suspicion. So I asked him a couple questions, and reasonable suspicion is kind of a joke. I can get it pretty much on anything. I knew the kid. I knew he's a drug user. To me, that's reasonable. So I said, saw you on camera. I need to check your pockets. Well, he knew exactly what I was looking for. He reached in his pocket. He had a water bottle, too. I thought he was going to hit me with that, but he reached in his pocket and went to do one of these. He tried to take a whole handful of drugs. So he wasn't going to get caught with those because he knew I really couldn't do anything if I couldn't identify them as narcotics or illegal prescription drugs. He was going to try to take them. Well, I jumped over the table. I swatted his hand and I tackled him on the floor. And turns out, had he taken those, his heart would have stopped within a couple minutes. So, and I'm in there rushing. My secretary thought I was being killed. So she calls for other help. I had the kid in the corner and the other two assistant principals come in, basically just pile drive all both of us. Of course, he gets away. I had him, and then he runs into me, and the kid gets away, and we had to chase him down again. And I mean, there's blood all over the office. He was all cut up. And the officer comes in, cuffs him, takes him out. And again, this is white, middle-class, rich, Horsehead School District. If it's happening there, the school district to the south of us, which is inner city, and certainly Buffalo, can't imagine what's going on in those schools. The ghetto behavior has definitely moved into the white middle class. It's decaying quickly. She talked about a major support structure for the white middle class. And I keep using the term white. It certainly could be the white-black class, could be the Mexican class, the Hispanic class, any class that you actually want to talk about. She just refers to it as the white ghetto. But one of the major structures that she argues, and I would agree with, is religion, an organized religion. And certainly that support structure is deteriorating very rapidly as well. A Gallup poll. And this Gallup poll was done, I think, from like 1990-something through the present time. And they asked a couple questions, and they asked the same questions over and over. So I took a look at the time, 2001. We know that was directly after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And most of us know that there was a rapid increase in people's need for religion. We go to church, it's all going to go away. Well, we know that didn't last very long. But right after then, they asked the question, at the present time, do you think religion as a whole is increasing its influence on American life or losing its influence? That was the question they asked. In 2001, 39% of the people polled thought that religion was losing its influence. Still a pretty high number. 39% thought it was losing influence. 55% of the people felt that it was increasing its influence. That same question asked last year, 2011, the results were very different. You can probably guess what happened to the numbers. In 2001, 71% of the people felt that the church was decreasing its influence over American life, which in 2001, that number was 39%. Now it's 71%. 21% felt that it was increasing its influence. So still a few, I guess, deceived people think that it's increasing its influence over American life. The same poll in 2011 asked people how often they attended church services. In 2011, 29% of the people polled said weekly, 61% said monthly, seldom, or never. And here's a real interesting one. 30% of the people felt that religion was old-fashioned and out of date. So this is what's happening to religion in our country. Without this important support system, the decay of American morality is sure to go even faster. We have nothing binding us together, teaching us what's right. Where it's only going to get worse, and it's going to get worse quicker. The corruption of our value system that our country was founded on, for the most part, has long been forgotten. We live by the laws of the flesh rather than the laws of the Spirit. Romans 8, verse 5 through 6. Romans 8, verse 5 through 6 speaks to kind of the direct opposite of the laws of the flesh versus the laws of the Spirit. Romans 8, verses 5 through 6. Those who live according to the flesh have their mind set on what the flesh desires. But those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their mind set on what the Spirit desires. The mind governed by the flesh is death, but the mind governed by the Spirit is life and peace. Romans tells us that under the current societal laws, which are the laws of the flesh, certainly is going to lead to death. But if we live by the laws of the Spirit, brethren, we will be delivered from this carnal world. Although we know that the current world is filled with corruption and really a complete lack of moral compass, God promises us that a time will come to pass when the bondage we currently know will disappear and we will be delivered. Another set of scriptures in Romans, this time in chapter 8, Romans 8, verses 18 through 21. Romans 8, 18 through 21 really acknowledges this corruption and the eventual deliverance from the evil one. Beginning in verse 18 of Romans 8, it says, "For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God." So again, we're promised that we are going to be delivered from what we see. Going back to Star Parker's book, has a title. One of the titles in the book, one of the chapters is entitled "Faith in the Ghetto." Faith in the Ghetto. The chapter reveals the depths to which we have sunken as a nation. It reveals that the moral decay of our country may be beyond repair. Her words from this chapter state the following: "Middle Americans must decide who will be their guide on the road to truth. Going to be those guys screaming on the side of the road? Or is it going to be what we hear when we come to Sabbath services? Is it going to be God and His words that are going to lead us to the road that we need to go down?" Here are some of the summaries of what is true for opposite ends of the moral spectrum. Again, this is one of the paragraphs in her book. Here are some of the summaries of what is true for the opposite ends of the moral spectrum in our culture. Those opposite ends are secularism and Christianity. We know that what we see now is only a fraction of the wrath to come. But we also know that God will deliver us and He will answer our prayers. 1 Thessalonians 1, verses 9 through 10 talks about that. 1 Thessalonians 1, 9 through 10 says, "For they themselves declare concerning what manner of entry we had to you, and how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Well, there's hope for some. We can turn from idols to worshiping the true God. We have already done that. The world has that opportunity still. Whom He raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. So Jesus Christ will deliver us from the wrath to come. Doesn't mean there's not going to be wrath, because there certainly is. But He will intervene before the entire world is destroyed. For God to deliver us from this wrath to come, we must choose Christianity over secularism. Those are the two opposite ends of the spectrum. And certainly we would add that we must choose true Christianity, not what the guys on the side of the street were screaming about on our way to church today. There's a difference, and we certainly know that. The chapter Faith in the Ghetto, if you read actually through that, which I'm not going to do, but if you read through that chapter, I'm not sure it's the right title for the chapter. The better title might be Lack of Faith in the Ghetto. Star asked a question. Star Parker, author of the book, asked a question. How did one nation under God arrive at this godless place? In the previous chapter in the book, talks about how the United States came to be founded under what most would consider Christian principles. So she kind of went through that history. So she makes this statement after that chapter. How did one nation under God arrive at this godless place? Many Americans, she says, would point to Hollywood and Washington. Probably a good place to start. Hollywood and Washington. Case in point, she says, Mel Gibson. He certainly got his faults, but she's using it to kind of show the movies that Hollywood will fund and the movies they won't fund. Mel Gibson, you know, he had to fund The Passion of the Christ on his own. Hollywood would not fund that movie. Why? Because it had a Christian twist to it. Was it 100% accurate? Certainly up for debate. Not the purpose of putting that in there, but just to show that Hollywood would not fund that movie because it had that Christian twist to it. But they rolled the red carpet out for a guy named Roman Polanski. And he made a bunch of movies. I really didn't know any of the movies that he made. But here's the type of guy that he was. He was a filmmaker, indicted on 6 counts of having sex with a minor. Also known ties to the serial killer, Charles Manson. Paid for all his movies. Rolled out the red carpet for him. Gave him all kinds of awards at the Hollywood Award ceremonies. I can't remember the names of all of them. Emmys, Golden Globes, the other host of awards that they have. Mel Gibson, certainly not a perfect guy, but compared to this guy, looks pretty good. The U.S. Supreme Court certainly has its faults as well. They have ruled many times to ban the posting of the Ten Commandments. But they really had no problem finding the anti-sodomy laws of Texas unconstitutional. Highest court in our land. This is what they're doing. Star goes on to discuss that people from every culture and religion recognize that maintaining traditional, cultural, and religious beliefs, tribal beliefs, religious beliefs of the family and community must be preserved. We have to preserve the family, is what she's saying. For example, adultery and divorce were both considered absolutely taboo. And certainly for us, still is. But if you look at society, not so much, not so taboo anymore. A couple divorce rate facts. Since 1970, marriage has declined 30%. Divorce has increased 40%. So we have less marriages, but more divorces. Women are the first to file for divorce 65% of the time. Over 40% of first marriages end within 13 years. 20% of first marriages end within 5 years. Over 75% of divorced people get remarried. The second time, they do even worse. 65% of the time, second marriages fail. This is what's happening to one of those structures that God set up that used to be held somewhat sacred by our culture, and taboo to go against that certainly isn't anymore. Now, you could certainly go into the premarital, just talk about premarital cohabitation increasing 70% since the 90s, and then how that somehow impacts, or in many times impacts, the divorce rate. It's clear that we are in desperate need of deliverance. That's clear. Galatians 1, 3 through 4. As we begin to wrap up, cut some pages out here so we can wrap up on time. Dr. Lambert asked me, hey, I think I'm going to go long. What can you do? I said, don't worry. Take as much time as you need. We'll adjust accordingly. So in Galatians 1, verses 3 through 4, Paul writes to the church in Galatia, Grace and peace to you from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. No mention of the Holy Spirit there, is there? Dr. Bryant talked about. He gave Himself for our sins to rescue us or deliver us from the present evil age, according to the will of our God and Father, to whom be the glory forever and ever. Amen. God will rescue us. We will be delivered from this present evil age. In Romans 11, verses 25 through 32, just do a couple scriptures that talk about, in a sense, some deliverance that God has already done that we can read about in the Bible. He's delivered His people throughout the ages from many different things, typically from the influence of Satan. So in Romans 11, 25 through 32, it says in 25, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers and sisters, so that you may not be conceited. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the further number of the Gentiles has come in. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. All Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. There will be a deliverer. We will be delivered. He will turn godless away from Jacob, and this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So there is a covenant, there is a promise that this will take place. Continuing in verse 28, it says, as far as the gospel is concerned, they are enemies for your sake. But as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs. For God's gifts and His calls are irrevocable. He made the promise that is not going to disappear. Just as you were at one time disobedient to God, have now received mercy as a result of their disobedience, so they too have now become disobedient in order that they too may now receive mercy as a result of God's mercy to you. For God has bound everyone over disobedience so that He may have mercy on them all. God has made the promise that there will be a time when we will be delivered from evil. God is a merciful God. In Exodus 12, verse 40, I'm not going to read the entire thing just for the sake of time, but in Exodus 12, verse 40, we know that Israel was delivered from Egypt. Again, just put in there to show the example that God has delivered His people in the past and will again at a time that we don't know, but certainly a time that God does know. So in Exodus 12, 40, it talks about Israel being delivered from Egypt. Sodom and Gomorrah, we certainly see that in our society today, maybe not to the extent that it was there, but I don't know, that may be arguable in some of the other Supreme Court decisions that have been made. Certainly Texas's decision there from the Supreme Court is a good example of that. But we know in Genesis 19, verse 29, that Lot was delivered. He was delivered out of, I can't even imagine that place, Sodom and Gomorrah. He was delivered from there. So again, I won't read it just for the sake of time. Certainly many more examples of God delivering His people and delivering the evils, delivering us from the evil of Satan. We have seen through the eyes of Star Parker, and I guess through my eyes with some of my stories as well, that our society is in a rapid state of deterioration. We are operating not by the laws of the Spirit, but by the laws of the flesh. Brethren, we're tempted on a daily basis, some more than others, but we are certainly all tempted to follow that law of the flesh. Thankfully, we know the proper law that we should be following. We've been blessed with the understanding that God will deliver us from this current evil age and the temptations of Satan the devil. Jesus taught us to pray for God's coming kingdom and that His will be done now. He also taught us to pray for God to deliver us from the evil one. As I said many times throughout the sermon, we are definitely in desperate need of that deliverance. But we can find peace in knowing that God has promised to fix all that plagues our world. We have that promise. We know that the time will come to continue to get more difficult. We know that Satan will continue to influence us through temptation and the false teachings. It's not going to get better. And we know with a lot of things, it's got to get worse before it gets better. But we can hold our hat on and understand and really take comfort in knowing that that time is coming. I'd like to close in 2 Peter 2, not 2 Peter. Peter chapter 2, verses 2 through 9. Beginning in verse 2, "But there were also false prophets among the people, just as there will be false teachers among you," screaming along the side of the road at you. "They will secretly introduce destructive heresies, even denying the sovereign Lord who brought them, bringing swift destructions on themselves. Many will follow their depraved conduct and will bring the way of truth into disrepute. In their greed, these teachers will exploit you with fabricated stories. Their condemnation has long been hanging over them, and their destruction has not been sleeping." In verse 4, "If God did not spare angels when they sinned, but sent them to hell, putting them in chains of darkness to be held for judgment. If he did not spare the ancient world when he brought the flood on its ungodly people, but protected Noah, a preacher of righteousness, and seven others. If he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by burning them to ashes and made them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. And if he rescued Lot, a righteous man who distressed by the depraved conduct of the lawless. For the righteous man living among them day after day was tormented in his righteous soul by the lawless deeds he saw and heard." And finally in verse 9, "If this is so, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to hold the unrighteous for punishment on the day of judgment. Brethren, let us continue to pray, deliver us from the evil one."